This is Fostering Conversations with Utah Foster Care, where we have insightful conversations about parenting for bio, foster, adoptive, or blended families to better understand the experiences we all face as families. Oh, we've got a good one today for you, and I owe it all to my dear co-host, Liz Rivera. This is all about open adoption, which we all know is very complicated. And Liz listens to podcasts religiously. So Liz, tell me why we're going to feature a podcast within a podcast today.
Yeah, which we've never done before. So I'm really excited we're having kind of a crossover episode. So yes, I am a very avid podcast listener. But this particular podcast came to my attention when Lynette and Sean were in training with me, and I got to know them a little bit in some comments. I asked them to drop the link to their podcast in the chat, and which they did, and I started listening to it and have been listening for several months now. And all the episodes are amazing, and I recommend this podcast to anyone who's interested in the adoption world, an adoptive parent, an adoptee. But there was one the other night I was listening to driving home about a very, very open adoption. And this one featured two mothers, and they're talking about their family situation. So I guess, Lynette and Sean, we'd like to hear a little bit about why you started this podcast.
Yeah. So this podcast has really evolved in the mission and purpose behind it. We started it out in April of 2021, and our initial goal was to talk about our own open adoptions and why we are huge advocates for open adoption based on our own personal experiences in our families.
Yeah, we got to the point where we had friends and friends of friends and 10 times removed friends coming to our home to talk about adoption. We personally have adopted 4 children. Those were all either agency or private adoptions at birth, not through foster care, but we have 4 very open adoptions and people were very interested to hear that. So we started with our own story, but that's morphed over time.
As we continued with the show, we started talking with other people about their adoption experiences, and that quickly became our favorite part of the podcast. And especially, we love featuring adoptees and hearing their experiences and perspectives. And we really try to focus on elevating all kinds of different experiences and voices and making sure to build a wider understanding, right? And help people see that there can be so many different ways to see adoption and experience it and focus on adoptees.
Yeah, when we received our initial training on open adoption, it was very focused on what adoptive parents had experienced and what they could do. But we quickly have realized that in order to help the adoptee, we need to hear from adoptees. We need to hear from first parents as well, so that we're just really well-rounded and don't have just one side of the story or one perspective. So that's what we've aimed to do over the last 85 plus episodes.
And one thing that is so important is the relationship between the two parents and fostering that. And I have an open adoption story in my family too. And what I've learned is that that relationship with the other parent, that enriches you as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's been a really beautiful experience, not only with our own open adoptions, but seeing how open adoption and letting go of maybe those insecurities or fears that we definitely had, and I know they're pretty common as we first dived into trying to understand what open adoption meant. As we let go of those insecurities, we really found that not only were our children receiving more love and more support, but even we were, and that's not the point, but it's this amazing benefit to open adoption as well.
We have so many birth parents or first parents and grandparents or kids, and maybe this just to really quickly illustrate, when they were really young, anyone who was older, they would walk up and say, is this one of my grandma's grandpa's? Because they have like 16 plus grandparents and they all accept them as their grandkids. And it's really just this huge village of a family that we've created with really the focus on blessing our kids, making sure that they feel connections and that they have answers to questions so that they can be well adjusted.
Wonderful. And I think you were speaking to, even though this episode we're sharing today is, as Deborah mentioned, between two parents, the fact that you guys privilege the voice of the adoptee so much, I found to be really enlightening. And I think that there's a push toward that now that, like you said, for so long, it's been the parent speaking, the professional speaking, and we haven't been listening to the lived experience of the adoptee as much.
Yeah, we personally don't know what it is, what it feels like to be an adopted person. We don't know the emotions, the internal emotions, the internal thoughts and feelings. And so if we're going to parent adoptees, we want to make sure that we have as much information as we can. And yeah, the podcast in general has just helped us so much in our ability to do that.
That's wonderful. So one quick question, because sometimes everybody would like their life to be beautiful and wonderful all the time. And I think that, you know, we've created this vision of adoption as beautiful and wonderful all the time. And yet we know that with any family situation, that's never true. And we have found sometimes that adopted parents struggle to hear an adoptee share an experience that isn't all wonderful. And I don't know if you've gotten any concerns from parents, adopted parents particularly, who said, I don't want to hear the struggle. I only want to hear when it's going well.
I think that's a very common struggle that people have, but it's challenging, right? Because when we take off those rose-colored lenses, we know that every experience is going to have good and bad, positive and negative. And some stories and some people's lived experience is so much more negative and others are really positive. And we've even seen within the same adoptive family where they're being raised by the same parents, these experiences can vary so greatly. And so I feel like the best way to approach that is to just be open and make it a safe place to hear whatever the adoptee is wanting to share, making it so that those conversations don't feel taboo. And so it is hard as adoptive parents or as foster parents or caretakers, we need to be able to check our ego and just put that away and keep our focus really on the adoptee or the child that we are taking care of.
Yeah. And I think maybe I would just quickly add that if our children or those that we're caring for can't be open and honest about their feelings around that, around their adoption, or around their being placed with a different family, then there's probably other elements or aspects of their lives that they're not opening up and sharing with us either. And so we need to, again, like Lynette said, check our ego as much as we can, make it a super safe place for our kids to come and come chat with us about anything. Whether or not that's going to hurt my feelings, I need to hear it because it's in them and they need to get it out.
And I think that's advice any parent should pay attention to, quite frankly, but especially in this case. Let's put on our listening ears again, and we're going to listen to the Open Adoption Project podcast. And the name of this episode, I think, is very appropriate. Two Mothers, Equal and Different.
Welcome to the Open Adoption Project. This is episode 84. We are the Nelsons. I'm Lynette.
And I'm Sean. In today's episode, we have a wonderful conversation with two amazing women.
Yes, today we get to talk to Stephanie Doyle and Amy Condi, and they are both incredible. So we should probably explain, just because it feels complicated at first, but as you listen, it's not, I promise.
It's awesome. I love
yes.
it.
Yes. So Stephanie and Amy are both mothers, and they share some of their kids, and they have like this big, like open adoption-esque kind of family. But their family started off being united like this through kinship, foster care, and then adoption. And they'll tell the story more. But they talk about how it started off that they did not like each other. And as you'll listen to them, you can tell that they have an immense love for each other and immense respect. And it's really, really powerful to hear how their relationship blossomed over time and has grown.
I wasn't here personally at our house when we recorded this episode. Lynette was here with them in our home. But I can tell, like, I don't even have to see them to know how close they are and like how good of friends they are. Like, the connection that they have with each other is so, so strong, and you'll hear that.
And yet, like, sincere and palpable. Yeah, yeah. It's really powerful. They're just,
they capitulate those goals that I have of being able to have those strong connections with our family, right? With our kids, biological family, who have become part of our family.
Yeah. So. Well, let's tell a little bit about them and let's jump into the recording.
Yeah. So just really quick, since this is a longer episode, but it's a really, really good one. So definitely
stick me into the end.
Yeah. Yes, yes, stay. But Stephanie is a roller derby regional champion. And Amy is a Burning Man enthusiast, with the distinction that she added that she's into like the regional Burning Man. And they are both really fun. Really just like automatically I felt like this connection to them and really liked them. They're very likable and really vulnerable. They talk about some really hard feelings and hard experiences.
But they do it in a way that's so positive and just really helpful. So we're really excited for you to listen to this conversation with Lynette, Amy, and Stephanie.
We're here on the podcast with Stephanie and Amy. Thank you so much, both of you, for being here.
It's so exciting to be here. Thanks for having us.
Yeah. So to start off, can you tell us about yourselves?
So my name is Amy Condi. I am an adoptive parent. I adopted three children to the foster care system. My first two children came to me when they were 6 and 3, and I was 23. My youngest came to me when he was 13 months old, and they are now 27, 25, and 16. So, and this is my older kid's mom.
My name is Stephanie Doyle, and I am a birth mother, and my kids went into the foster care system in March of 2001. They were removed from my care due to me being addicted to methamphetamines and just not caring for my kids properly. How I guess Amy and I are related, I guess, is you can't see my quotes here. is she was married to my ex-husband, my oldest boy's father, at the time of the removal of my kids. So her and my ex-husband wanted to get custody of my oldest boy. And that's how they got involved in the process of foster care and adoption.
Yeah. So, yeah, our daughter, our shared daughter, she is not, so she's not biologically related, but she was biologically related to a biological relation. That's how we're kinship family. And so, I was a step parent and a foster parent for two of Stephanie's kids, basically.
Yeah. And awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. So those, and that we like call those our children because they are our children. Yeah. But then like I have my son that I think is separate. Mm-hmm. And then she has her son that's a little separate. Mm-hmm. But then those two boys, like they kind of think of themselves as brothers because mm-hmm. they share siblings.
Yeah, so, they're all family. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just a big family. And yeah. We didn't start that way. Mm-hmm. When Stephanie was going through her drug addiction, first of all, she was a different person, and drugs really like affect people in ways that change their personalities. Yeah. But also just, yeah, I think it's interesting about emotional maturity. We were talking about that earlier in the idea that we were both 23 years old and we're trying to manage the lives of these like little people. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I think we both felt like we were really old. Mm-hmm. There's no way now 20 years later, 22 years later.
Oh my gosh.
That we would, like, there's no way that I would imagine that I would be sitting next to this person and being like, yeah, she's great. She's amazing. We didn't start out that way. We started out very hostile, very mm-hmm. much like I was the baby stealer and she was the drug addict.
Mm-hmm. She was my ex-husband's wife. I mean,
that's a tricky dynamic.
Yeah. It's just a whole different dynamic. And I was also on drugs and So I'm not thinking clearly. I'm also very selfish as a person, because to me, all my kids needed was me. And even though I couldn't care for them properly and I wasn't coherent most of the time because I was on drugs, the selfish part of me was like, my kids don't belong to anybody else and don't need to be anywhere else. And so it was a dynamic that she didn't like me and I didn't like her. And it's kind of how it was at first.
Yeah. That went on for a long time. Mm-hmm. Like maybe close to a year of the kids being in care of, and then, so we had our, permanency hearing. Yes. We had our permanency hearing, that basically is just to decide if the children should be adopted or whatever. And at that hearing, I felt like I had like won this great battle. You know, we were in this war for what's in the best interest of the children. And I was like super excited because now these children were going to likely come to me. That was the plan. That was all those things. And Tyler, like our oldest, was placed with us at that time. That was permanent custody at that time too. And so, but like Stephanie left that exact same hearing with a totally different understanding.
Yeah. I, again, didn't understand what was going on throughout the process, mainly because I was on drugs the majority of the time. But permanency to me, what I thought it was is DCFS said, we're no longer offering services to you. And I was like, great. I don't have to jump through your hoops. All I have to do. And I was in jail at the time. So this is like kind of where my thinking was. All I have to do is get out of jail, get a job, get a house, and my kids can come home. And I was just completely naive about the situation and had no idea what was actually happening and what permanency really meant at that time. So.
Yeah. Like Stephanie disappeared for some time. Mm-hmm. It was really, there was a lot of disruption within mm-hmm. that time when we were there, but I felt like, but the difference was that I also started to change after permanency. So between permanency hearing and our termination trial, there was like 3 months mm-hmm. of time. And in that time I went through this drastic emotional shift within me that basically I became a mother. And I, for people who've gone through foster care, I think that they understand this idea, but for people who don't understand, I just imagine that like children that you barely know are just brought to your home and then they're like, hey, love them, but like not so much that you can't give them back when it's time. You're just holding on to them temporarily. I felt like a babysitter, like a 24/7 babysitter and at any time, all she had to do was get those things.
Yeah.
And we would like, I would no longer be a mother to these children, especially for Lexi, because I had no ties to her otherwise. She could have just completely disappeared. And so that's our daughter's name. I don't know if I said that. Anyway. But I became this mother and it was a whole different thing. I've never been a mom before. These were kids just, hello, instant family. And so I developed this different feeling of empathy and compassion because I was also not a perfect mother, believe it or not, at 23. It's weird. I had like all of these like flaws, but I had to hide those from everyone, right? Couldn't let anybody know that I was struggling or having a hard time with these kids because then they'd think I wasn't capable and they'd take them away. That's it's a challenging dynamic within the foster care system of not being able to admit when like things are wrong, not being able to say I'm struggling. And I really was struggling, but not like to the level that they needed to be removed, just that I felt ashamed of that. But when it came time for our trial, I really had a different vibe about Stephanie. And as a foster parent, you get to sit through the whole trial. And this is my husband's ex-wife. And what a betraying, awful feeling that only as our ex-husband now has developed a new wife, do I really fully understand that that would have been so terrible. But like watching her have to testify and have to try to make something out of really nothing. There was like very little to have a defense about.
and to be testified against from so many different police officers, because I've been arrested so many times. There's probably an officer from like every city in the county there. And my daughter's dad saying a bunch of awful, untrue stuff. You know, the majority of what had happened was true that the DCFS brought and stuff like that. But just, it was just, you're under, every one of your flaws is under a microscope, and you are just sitting in a courtroom full of people with person after person saying how awful of a person you are and how awful of a mother you are, which is something that should just be like, I guess, like as a woman, I felt like the one thing that should be natural to me, to be a good mom and a protective mom and a caring mom, I failed that. And I think that's when things started to shift for me with Amy as well, was during that trial. I think I started to realize, listening to all of that negative stuff about me, that I was being selfish and I couldn't offer my kids what they needed.
It took a couple of days. I'm so sorry to interrupt, but like the first day, like when
super so defiant.
I had to testify, and in the middle of my testimony, like they asked me how I felt about my daughter, who wasn't my daughter at that time, but it doesn't matter. Asked me how I felt about it. And I said that I felt really like she was completing our family, and Stephanie could not tolerate that at all. Slams her hands down on the table, disrupts the whole courtroom, gets in huge trouble, like while I'm on the witness stand. It was just so, we didn't like each other.
Not a smart thing to do in court either. Just not.
But so, yeah, because we had to go for one day, and then weeks pass and you come in for another day of trial. Yeah. It was so, just such a weird thing.
It was awful.
But I think we both had these shifts, because I've spent the first day feeling sorry for Stephanie and like actually like calculating through my life if I had done just this one little choice different.
Yeah.
Or anything, I could have easily ended up in the same place with four kids by the time I was 21 years old. Mm-hmm. And why did you develop a meth problem? That's such a surprise and a shock.
Yeah.
That's so easy.
I know.
It's such an easy life you had.
Yeah. Well, and having those four kids under the age of four, and then there, my daughter's dad left and I was working at a bar, and the manager of the bar, who was like a 40-something year old man, said, "Hey, try this." And instantly I was addicted. So that's pretty easy.
And I had experienced some things that I was like, if I'd have gotten caught doing that, or if this had, that we weren't that far apart. Mm-hmm. And more importantly, that like love is separate from being able to parent.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That was my first experience of like distinguishing between those two things, because she had like a picture of the kids that said like hope on it. And there was like no hope here. But how do you give up hope as a mother? How do you let that go? Yeah. And finally seeing her in a mother, we are the same.
Yeah.
And yeah, that also realizing that this tragic thing is happening. A family is being ripped apart forever. And I had no idea what that was even. I had no concept of what that could even feel like. But that's what was happening right there in my family. Mm-hmm. I had to go home and tell my kids, like, a judge decided that your mom's not your mom anymore. And not both of them either. Like, that was a really confusing piece, because she's still Tyler's legal mother. That never had to change because, it just didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But because now this person, I'm going to be on this kid's birth certificate, but not this kid's birth certificate. Mm-hmm. And explaining all of that was just, it was tragic, and I didn't know what to do with it, but that like the tragedy was happening in front of me to this woman that I felt a lot of empathy for suddenly. I have to call it like a divine intervention. I didn't have that capability to do that.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing.
It grew. It came. Yeah. It came later. Yeah.
Well, no, what like, so she comes, we end court, you lose your rights.
Yep.
And we're walking out of court, and these are just like, as I'm like remembering these memories. It's like such a disgusting feeling of just tragicness. But she comes running toward me, and I honestly thought maybe she was coming to hit me. Like, she just lost the rights to her kids. And instead, she like wraps her arms around me and just hugs me and says, take care of our kids. And I'm like, you know I will. But it was like this passing of a thing. But also, my whole body said, why is this? Why do we have to do this? But she really was addicted to drugs. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we had to do it. Yeah. But yeah, sorry, you go.
Well, and she talked about like divine intervention. I think about that moment and what caused me to do that. Like, it was some sort of something pushing me and saying, hey, you need to tell this person to take care of our kids or whatever. And I think it was also me just also passing the torch to her and saying, it's okay for you to be their mother. I mean, we still had like lots of weirdness and awkwardness for a long time, but I finally started to wake up a little bit and know, you know, I wasn't what was best for them.
Yeah.
And, you know, after the trial, things kind of went on my own way. And, I think it was probably like 3 or 4 months after the trial, I had committed a lot of crimes, and it was getting close to me being sentenced for these crimes. But I figured out of the blue, maybe I should call them because I had their phone number. I mean, you know, it's my ex-husband. I knew their number, and just see if she'll talk to me about the kids. Like, I didn't expect anything from it. In fact, to be honest, she could have. What I expected was her just to hang up on me. You know, she didn't have to talk to me. When I called her, we talked for a long time on the phone, and both talked about our fears of,
it was the first time that we'd been vulnerable in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, it's always been guarded.
And it was the first time that we'd actually interacted without like a bunch of other people, like DCFS people were looking, or attorneys, or just gross things that make everything complicated. Yeah. So I think it was a time to be vulnerable. Yeah. And sorry, go ahead.
That was it. Like, we both realized that I think that we both love those kids.
Yeah.
And that we both have like the exact same fears. Like, my biggest fear was that my kids would forget about me and not want me at any of the important events in their life and wouldn't care. And her biggest fear was that all the kids would want is me there and wouldn't care if she was there.
Yeah.
And that was just, I guess it was really kind of interesting. So we talked for a long time, and then she like did something crazily amazing and invited me to come over and see the kids.
I'm super impulsive.
Yeah. And I went over there and I got to see the kids, and they were so excited to see me, and they were so like excited about to show me everything in their house. And they took me to their room. And I went in their bedroom, and they had a picture of me hanging up on their wall. And it was a healthy picture of when I was younger. And I felt like she had not let them forget me and kind of invited me to still be a part of their lives by having that picture hanging in their room. And that was just like a really amazing moment for me. I was just really overwhelmed to see that. And I think that's kind of the start of everything.
Yeah. I think we accepted that we both could be there, that it was our issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was our inability to like tolerate our own emotions and or be safe. Like that was another thing. So in that conversation, we talked about, and I don't think that in the moment, there's no way that we knew this was going to be such a meaningful conversation that would like guide our whole whatever for the next whatever long. But it really was like, I said to her, you've got, because at this time she was still doing a lot of things that were very unpredictable and unsafe, you know? And so like, you need to have some sobriety. You need to have like be working on things. But more importantly, when you tell the kids that you're going to come, you're going to show up.
Yeah. Yes.
Because we had done things before that they'd not, like, yeah. not shown up to things. And it's just so, that's really hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard. It, like, with our daughter's biological dad, there's a whole side story yeah. to this. But he would keep promising to show up and never mm-hmm. showed up. And, like, this went on for just a long time. And he just had to finally be like, no, you don't get access yeah. anymore because you can't keep promising a little yeah. person. That's not fair. Yeah. It's not okay.
Yeah.
It's better for you to be away.
Yeah.
But that you would, you know, stop promising mm-hmm. things that you couldn't deliver on, but they would be honest, and just that we could envision, just even imagine. I think this is 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
In today's society, the idea of co-parenting is so popular.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
This was a foreign,
it was not a thing. Yeah, yeah.
It was the 90s.
And you know? Open adoptions, too, was not a thing.
Not at all.
In the state of Utah, especially. It was just, you know, it was, because Utah has closed adoptions. I don't think that's changed at all.
I
know that they really pushed for it.
For open adoption. Yeah. There wasn't a legal way to have an open adoption. There is now.
Okay.
So, yeah. And like, we haven't mentioned that she had two other children,
yeah.
the twins that are a year younger than Lexi, yeah. but that, like, that shift and the differences between those mm-hmm. things. And I guess we can compare that a little later yeah. in the story, but at the time, it was really important to me that Stephanie be a consistent piece, even if it was just once a year mm-hmm. or letters or whatever that looked mm-hmm. like. Find where you're going to be. But for right now, come and visit because, you know, they really want to see you.
Yeah.
There was no way. And I mean, I don't think anyone should erase your adoption history. I think you should mm-hmm. tell your children their adoption story every single moment you have a mm-hmm. chance. It's their life story.
Yeah.
But I think it was really challenging to give a story for what was happening
mm-hmm.
because this isn't supposed to happen.
Yeah.
Adoption really... Like infant adoption, that's a whole different thing. But yeah. something tragic has to happen in our family
mm-hmm.
for our family to even exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so telling our story to our kids about our kids has been helpful. But also, I think it's important to just have that piece that says, mm-hmm. this is why we did it. And I couldn't erase her.
Yeah.
I couldn't just say, like, you know what, guys, I'm your new mom. That other mm-hmm. person, she's not your mom. But here's the thing that really shocks me is that there's people out there in the world who believe that is true.
Mm-hmm.
And still to this day, believe that is true.
Doesn't work that way.
It never will. You can't just erase someone's history or give it, like people who give new names. Mm-hmm. Like the twins got new names mm-hmm. when they were adopted. When they were finally adopted at 7, they got new first names.
And they also got cut off from seeing their siblings, which, you know, they have that right. And I don't want to, like, diss them. And in fact, I've gotten to know them really well in the last probably
5 years.
And so I understand a lot of more why they did what they did. But that was really difficult for the girls and especially for Tyler and Lexi. Because they were old enough to remember their siblings. So, you know, like,
here's two of your sisters who just, they exist in some place in this county. Yeah. Maybe we'll bump into them.
Yep.
But one day when we did bump into them, their mom literally dragged them away.
Mm-hmm.
Like, wouldn't let us talk to them.
Yeah.
And I used to really try to feel a lot of empathy for that. But that really was, like, from my perspective, the wrong thing to do. Mm-hmm. I can't come up with how that was an okay thing to do.
Yeah.
It really hurt my children.
Yeah.
And so from our perspective, even at that time when open adoption wasn't being promoted, mm-hmm. there was no way that we could consider anything but an open adoption.
Yeah. Oh.
And if we're going to have to do that for the rest of our lives, why not make it reasonable, at least tolerable.
Yeah.
And even as we grew, now Stephanie went to prison for a long time.
Yep.
How long were you in prison?
A little over 2 years total.
Yeah.
So,
well, you tell your prison story.
Actually, 3 years. So after that phone call, we started doing visits, and Amy had been taking our kids to my family reunion, which was a huge thing, while I was not there. And so they, she was maintaining that relationship with my family. And so we just kind of got to know each other a little bit more. I was still using.
So like 3 months after the phone call.
So we started developing a relationship and started talking. And then I got sentenced to probation federally and then to do a year in Utah County Jail and 3 years probation. So we decided to invite Amy and the kids to a dinner, my going away party. And we took our kids to Sizzler, and my mom and everybody was there because I was going to turn myself in the next day.
I want to add in the telling the truth part.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So from where we talked about the story till right now, like having a story to tell. So one of the things that, that I did thinking I was protecting my kids was to tell them not the truth. I didn't lie necessarily. I just said things like, your mom's sick and she's going away to places to get better. And like kind of painting it over in a weird way that to me made their little tender hearts hear it better. Mm-hmm. But what it actually did was really confuse them. Mm-hmm. And I found that out when mom didn't get better. She's now having like, she's going away to jail. And now we have to talk about what that means. And I realized during this time about the importance of like telling the truth about drugs, that kids really can understand drugs, even if they're only 4 years old.
Yeah.
And that they can understand the concept of like making a bad choice and needing like a grown-up timeout. And so we really started at that time to really tell our story in more honest and genuine ways, which was really a valuable piece.
Yes.
So like when it came time for you to go to jail.
Yes. Yes. So we went out to dinner. By this time, the kids were very comfortable with the fact that I was going to jail. And our kids have never been quiet and never been shy. So we're in Sizzler and the lady comes up and Tyler's all, my mom's going to jail tomorrow, and just telling her. And so it's
that's why we're here at dinner.
Yeah,
we're here. We don't really live with her.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. They're just really open and honest with people. Mm-hmm. So I went to jail, and Amy decided, well, especially our oldest boy, Tyler, was very nervous about me being in jail. He thought it was, you know, like you see on TV where they give you like bread and water and slide it under the door and you're in an old like pit or whatever with, so he was nervous. And so she started driving by the jail saying, hey, look, it's just a building. This is what it is. And Tyler asked her, well, why can't we just go in? And so, yeah, I'll let you tell that part because I think it's pretty interesting.
Well, again, to really try, it was hard. We had to build a relationship with someone who's literally locked away in a building and we're going through therapy. We're doing all of that stuff, trying to, you know, manage this tragic thing that had happened. So, deciding to go visit in jail, I got so much like negative feedback from people. And I laugh about it because I think people just haven't really considered it. They live in their bubble. And like here in this valley, a lot of people live in a lot of different bubbles, which is fine. But they don't really include jail visits in those bubbles. Yeah. But like people would say to me, you know, if you take your kids to the jail, they're going to think that it's okay to go to jail. And they're going to be like fine breaking the law when they're adults. And there was a little bit of me that was like, maybe that's true. But what if it's not? What if like they need to see that their mom's okay? What if that's actually way more important? That like we have to make jail okay because mom's there.
Talk about play therapy with Tyler.
Yeah. So Tyler would, he would take me, we were doing this thing called filial therapy, which is a caregiver and the child. And then the therapist like watches. And so he had this routine. And I mean, it was like, it didn't take a master's degree, honestly, what's wrong with this child. But like, he would grab all of the like police stuff and then he'd arrest me. And then he would take me over to the corner and then tell me how bad I was. And I was in jail. And I'd be like, okay. And then he would go get every food item in the play therapy room to bring to me to give me all of the food, like to take care of me, right? So the kind, this like punishing police officer, kind jailer. And this went like over and over. That happened multiple times. And like, that's just not, he needs to know that his mom's okay in jail, maybe. So I figured out how to do family visits and we figured that out. And that, what was that? That was outside of my comfort zone. I'm going to put it that way. But when I looked at, is this harming my children? Yes, they are sad. Yes, they are like distressed that, you know, their life isn't the way it is, but really their life isn't the way it is. And we have to like find ways to make that okay. Like probably two or three visits in, Lexi's like skipping down to whatever the ski resort is called.
Yeah.
At the Utah County Jail, they name all the places after ski resorts, which is just mean.
Oh, I agree. Wow.
Like you're housed in Snowbird.
Yeah.
Really interesting.
But yeah, so she's like skipping down there and you're like meeting between the glass. It's literally how you see it on, they don't even do that anymore anyway, but yeah, on this little phone thing, it's just exactly like you see it on television. But this is their mom. Yeah. And all of a sudden, she started to look a little bit healthier because she wasn't having a lot of access to meth.
Yeah. Like I started to put on some weight and that, I call it the soul comes back, the light comes back in the eyes, because there's something about when somebody's doing drugs that they've just got this vacant.
Yeah.
I don't know. And so, you know, they got to see that light come back on and they got to see me get healthy. And it was amazing to, that she would bring them there to visit me. And, you know, I always look forward to those visits and we started to develop a little bit of a relationship. I was only in jail for, I think, about 7 months. And jail is what I call, I haven't been there in years and I don't ever want to go back to find out what it's like now, but it's a very stagnant place where it was. And you're constantly bombarded with people coming in off the street that are high or that are detoxing from drugs. And you're just around the same people that you use with and you get in trouble with. And I didn't put any effort into really changing my life. So when I was released from jail, I was using again within 2 weeks. I didn't change anything about my life. I didn't change the people that I hung out with. I just, nothing changed. So Amy and Reed started like, you know, immediately having visits with me when I got out of jail. And I think that we kind of rushed into, they may have kind of rushed into things a little bit, but
I think so. At the time, I really believed that it was safe, right? Because you weren't with the kids alone ever, really.
No.
Like your brother was always there. Yeah. Your mom was blocks away. Yeah. I don't know that it was necessarily unsafe. I think I was naive. Yeah. I think that I thought, because you'd been away from meth. Why would you go back to this drug? Like,
We were both.
Just, I thought for sure that anybody who had gone that long in jail without the drug in their body, that they would be recovered.
Yep.
That would just be the magical cure.
Right.
Just time. That's all you needed.
Oh,
and so that was, you know, that was kind of naive on everyone's part. Let's again remember that we are like 25 years old.
We were younger than that.
No, the kids come to live with me when I'm 23. And this is like 2 years later. So like 24, 25. We're the same age.
We were 24 because I went to prison when I was 24.
There you go.
Yeah. Okay, that makes
sense. So let's just calculate. I often have to do this calculation.
I know.
That we are in our young 20s.
I know. It's crazy.
And we're just like, why didn't we know this?
I know.
Oh, I don't know. But yeah, so I think we jumped into it. I think the kids were really excited.
Mm-hmm.
They were really excited that you were going to be around.
Yeah.
And that they didn't have to go to the jail anymore.
Yeah. And I could touch them and,
yeah,
you know, play with them. But unfortunately, that didn't last. I think I made it 3 months before I was arrested again. And I was on both state probation and federal probation. So when I was arrested again, I was violated on both of those probations. So when I got arrested again in March of 2004, I was sentenced to 0 to 5 years in Utah State Prison. So I was transferred up to Utah State Prison. And Amy and I decided that while I was in prison that it would be best if we didn't do in-person visits because the kids could be subject to some pretty scary things like full body searches or if something were to happen while they're there. We just felt, both of us felt it just wasn't a good thing. But we started, like, I would call them all the time. I would write letters. Amy would write letters to me. And we started kind of really to develop, Amy and I started to develop more of a relationship one-on-one when I went to prison through letters and phone calls. And I got released from Utah State Prison after 16 months. And I was transferred to a federal holding facility in Daggett County. This waiting for me to be sentenced on my federal stuff. And I had talked to my probation officer and my attorney, and they're like, listen, they're probably just going to reinstate your probation and let you out. You've done this much time. So I was really excited to get out. And then it was the day before Mother's Day, and I got a call over the PA that I had a contact visit. And I was like, this has got to be like my probation officer or my lawyer or something. And I walked into the room, and Amy had figured out how to get a contact visit, driven for 3.5 hours with our children just so they didn't have to go another Mother's Day without seeing me. And I think that solidified my relationship with her, that this person truly loves our children and she loves me too. She's not going to do that, you know, just, you know, for the heck of it. And I was so amazed that I got to touch these kids that I hadn't touched in over 16 months and, you know, got to see them and how big they are. And we made all these plans for when I was going to get out because I was going to court on Monday. And it was just an amazing experience that she would do that. But come Monday, I had to make a pretty devastating phone call. The federal judge said, hey, I'm afraid if I let you out and reinstate your probation, you're just going to violate again. So I'm going to sentence you to 1 year and a day in federal prison. And when they take you to federal prison, they immediately take you and put you on Conair. So you're like handcuffed in an airplane and you end up in a federal holding facility in Oklahoma. So I had to call that night and say, I'm not coming home for in federal time. You do like 80% of your time. And so I was like at least another 11 months. That was devastating. But I'm actually truly thankful that I did go to federal prison. I don't know if I was ready to get out at that time. Do you want to talk about how you feel about that?
Yeah. I mean, Stephanie makes a joke sometimes. She'll say, like, if you're going to go to prison, go to federal prison. You know,
I agree with that.
Yeah. I agree. It's the best of the prisons.
Yes.
So, like, she was out in Phoenix in this, like, work camp.
Yep.
There aren't any fences. There's like just the city that is run by the inmates. Yeah. And it was really interesting to see her grow and change within that community based environment. I'm a strong proponent for that because it really did help her. She'd done some schooling, like she got her high school diploma in state prison, but like federal prison, she had a job. She learned a trade. She learned all of these things. And also her desire for improvement was so obvious. Mm-hmm. There was like, it wasn't just, there was some responsibility. Like, I think one of the things that you were talking about what changed and how are we able to make this happen? If Stephanie was still in that blaming stage where she used to be, you know, like if that caseworker hadn't done this or if that, whatever, I'd have my kids. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
No, it's true. That's where I was.
So, but in federal prison, there was some accountability. There was some shifts in like responsibility. There was some maturity emotionally.
Absolutely. Yeah,
weird. Definitely. There was maturity emotionally for me as well, in that like seeing and envisioning that I could be friends with this person. Mm-hmm. Wasn't just like before that, I was mostly doing it for my kids, sacrificing like my time and my things for my kids. That's what you do as a mom. But I began to care about Stephanie in different ways. Like I really was invested in her being successful, because if she was successful, all of us would have more success. Our whole family would be better off if she could be better off. And really believing that she could do it. And that, like, when she got out of federal prison, it was amazing. Yeah. She even chose to stay longer, which was so weird.
They offered me to get out early to go to a halfway house, and I was too scared of getting out and messing up at a halfway house, because if I would have messed up, I would have gotten new charges and I wouldn't have gotten out of the federal system. So I was like, nope, I'm just going to stay the extra month and terminate my case with the feds, because I was so paranoid about me making a mistake. So, but coming home was amazing. I think all of us were super excited. They threw me what's called like a coming out party, which was pretty awesome.
That's amazing.
That actually concludes chapter one. Yeah. All right. So there is a chapter two. Yeah. So yeah, when you came home, it really was like a different chapter, a different chapter in our lives. You were in such a radically different place than even the year that you'd been there before. Yeah. And so it was really good to experience that connectedness. Yeah. But I was 100% invested in your well-being. And I don't regret that investment at all.
No, I had to do an assignment. I'm in grad school right now. And I had to do an assignment in my cultural diversity class about who is one of the most like influential supports in your life. Yeah. And I couldn't, there was like, of course my mom, you know, but like everybody says your mom, whatever, but I had to think like, who is the person that has been there? And I had to choose her, because I don't know where I'd be without her, because she invested so much in my recovery and was so supportive of me through like every step. And so I had to like copy the assignment and send it to her, because I was like, I just need you to know this.
So, that's so beautiful.
But it's just, she did. She supported me. And then we started to build our relationship. I got a
coming
job.
Out party. Yes. I'll tell that story. Yes. So at this point, we're kind of normalized in our little family, right? Nobody's feeling super awkward. Mm-hmm. So we have a family. We have a party, her coming out party. She'd just gotten a job and started a job. And so like things were really looking up, because it was really hard for you to find a job. Yeah. And so we're like hanging out together. And that's her ex-husband, my current husband, and our two children, right? Yeah. This really interesting little thing. But we were all fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
This guy from work calls her and it's like, hey, what are you doing? What's up? I'd like to take you out. She's like, well, I'm hanging out at my ex-husband's house. Would you like to come over? And like,
he was like, hard pass, but thanks.
She's married to that guy now. Yeah. But like, it was just, sometimes we'd get wake up calls. Like when we'd go out in public or something, you know, there'd be this mom thing. And this was way before it was cool to be lesbian in public, you know? And so it just, people would give us strange looks and all sorts of stuff. When we go out with our husband, we just look like really infertile polygamists, you know? But like I think when we finally said like, we didn't actually care what other people thought, that was a big step in at least at that time, because I'd be like, oh, I was hanging out with Stephanie, and people would look at me so weird. Yeah. Like, why? Why are you doing that? Why are you going and hanging out with her? Like, you weren't even on a visit with the kids. You didn't, like, you just went and did stuff because you enjoy her.
Yeah.
Like, but that's really what it took, I think, for us to move through and be where we are, is we had to actually care about each other. Mm. In a different way that wasn't about like, oh, well, we just get together because of the kids.
No.
But yeah, we did get together because of the kids. Yeah. I think we get together a lot less now, certainly, because the kids are adults and it's just not. But when they were little, like we would spend. So we decided that Christmas, we didn't want to have two Christmases. That's so dumb.
Yeah.
And so she would come to my house and spend the night on Christmas morning. And like, as the kids got older, I went to her house, we built our family in routines and in acceptance and belonging.
Yes.
I love that. Wow.
That we all belong.
Yeah.
We all belong just simply because we decided to do this all together.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And I don't think our kids, I do think that our kids are way better because of it, because they never had to choose. They never had to feel like, oh, I need to do this for my mom or for, well, I was mommy, she was mom. That's what they called us.
And even like they would use our names, like they still do. Yeah. Like my kids call me Amy or mom.
Yep.
And I do not hear the difference.
Yep, I don't either.
And so it's just, it became this like really, and what was so funny when they were little, sometimes they would say mom and neither one of us would respond.
We would just like,
be like, oh, I thought you were talking to her. So that title, like, oh man, when Lexi first called me mom, we're going to go back for a second. The first time Lexi called me mom was in front of Stephanie, which was so hard and awkward.
Yeah.
But when you let go of those titles, when you let go of needing to be the mom or the dad, and you're like, oh, I'm a mom. Yeah, just the other day when I introduced you, like, this is my kid's mom. And you're like, and this is my kid's mom. Yeah. We just love to make people's eyes go, what? Are you this lesbian?
Yeah. Yeah, it just, she's right. Once you let go of that, like, jealousy, and our kids gain from that. They gain two moms and two dads and multiple sets of grandparents and... Yes. You know, never had to choose, oh, I'm going to go to Christmas here or spend this holiday here or spend my birthday here. I mean, we celebrated their birthdays together. It was just, it was everything. And, you know, it was just amazing. And I think that was the best gift that we could give our kids.
Yeah.
Was to have that. And I'll tell you right now, like our kids have their own little issues. They're young adults, but they are probably the most like well-adjusted when it comes to not abusing substances. They want nothing to do with that. Not in any type of criminal trouble at all. In fact, you know, they are very...
Yeah, they never went to jail.
Yeah,
weird,
I know.
So far. Well, and it'll be okay if they do.
Yeah. Just very... And emotionally compassionate. To people.
After I adopted the kids, then DCFS felt like this place that I should work for 10 years. So I did my time there. But like, I've seen so many different ways to adopt and so many different people who have perceptions about adoption. Mm-hmm. And I was really always blown away. Like people would think, if I just do these things, right? If I just do these things, then it will erase all of that trauma. Yeah. And in some ways, I've bought into that sometimes too. But I think what really helped us was to find acceptance for what had happened.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think our kids are ashamed of your story. Mm-hmm. I think if anything, they're like, yeah, my one mom's been to prison.
Yeah, they like to joke about that.
But like... there's nothing to hide. Mm-hmm. There was a few times when they were teenagers that they would like triangulate us and then we'd be like,
one in
what?
Particular.
We're not going to mention any names because, you know, but like they, or, you know, sometimes it would be like, well, I'm going to go over to Stephanie's house because I can do that over there.
And then she would have to call me and say, hey, this is what they said. And I'd be like, that's bull crap. And we did that. I guess that's kind of what we did. So we really co-parented our kids and they would come over and spend time with me. And we physically, when we would do drop off and pick up, we would have a big conversation. We usually hung out for an hour or so while we did that. And it was constant communication about what the kids were doing, what behaviors they were having. You know, we called each other all the time. Most of the time, the kids did not pull anything on us, but it did happen a couple times as they got a little bit older to do that triangulation.
Test those boundaries, you know, figure out if you're safe or not. But like, it was, as you know, even through the really, there were really challenging parts. Mm-hmm. I don't think that we had kids that were just easy. There were some things that were really challenging. And if I hadn't had Stephanie there, sitting in the courtrooms with me, sitting in all of those things with me, I don't know what I would have done. I would have been so lost. These people that don't understand, you're gaining an extra parent.
Yes.
When I needed respite, hey, go to your mom.
Yep.
And and trusting in that and feeling like that was okay. And that didn't happen overnight, but I don't think that it could have happened if we couldn't have let go of like living in jealousy.
Yeah.
Right. Like there are jealousies. There's times when you're like, wait, do you love her more than me? Yeah. And then you remember, oh, that's what a child thinks. Adult maturity says my kids can absolutely love as much as I can love them equally and different. Yeah. Our kids can love us equally and different.
Yeah.
And we always talked about our jealousies too. I think we'd always say, I'm a little bit jealous about this. And it made it easier for us, I think.
Yeah, normalizing the vulnerable. I love that.
Well, that we couldn't pretend that we were like this Hallmark card family.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're not a Hallmark card family. We're this weird family. But I'm so grateful that we were able to go outside of the box of people trying to erase histories or people like, and not to bring up the twins as much anymore, because it feels a little betraying to some of their privacy. Yeah. But like when the kids turned 18, so that was, the girls came and lived with Stephanie like within a few months of turning 18. Yeah. And then Lexi decided that she also needed to go and live with Stephanie. So she had a 19-year-old and two 18-year-olds. Yeah. Just boom, here you go. You're the birth mom.
Yeah. That was rough. My twin daughters have a lot of trauma from being completely cut off from their family. And again, you know, I'm not trying to like badmouth their adopted family. I think they're great people and they did the best that they could do with what they have. But you know,
I'm going to challenge that because I think that they were given an example because I was talking to them the whole time.
That's true.
I was saying to them, hey, things are safe. Things are appropriate. Things are going okay. Not the whole time, but for a while, because then they finally cut us all off and that's whatever. I think people acting out of fear make really interesting choices. So I'm going to say that they were acting out of fear. But I don't think that they like had no idea how to do it different. They did know how to do it different. And they had people telling them, hey, you don't have to cut them off. Mm-hmm. You don't have to do this. And they're like, nope, that's what we're going to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was their choice.
Maybe that's, I still have a lot of bitter feelings. And maybe you've forgiven a lot more and because you've had to.
Yeah.
You've been like you've had to do the exact same thing that I had to do for you.
Yep.
That's such an interesting thing that I don't even know that I've put together because, you have to be, because you're literally the adopt. So Stephanie actually adopted one of the twins.
Yes, I did.
After they, so.
So she's legally and biologically my daughter again.
So, but she's now the adoptive parent to those parents and you have to love them because they're your kids' parents. And I'm still stuck in some, because I haven't had to do that.
But she also was there with the trauma of them losing their siblings, where I was in prison and I didn't see everything that happened. And so she had to work through that. So I understand.
Well, and I feel lied to and betrayed, to be fair, because I was told your family will never stop talking to you. We'll never do that. And then within months of finalizing their adoption, they were like, nah, this is a bad idea.
Yeah.
And never spoke to us again.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not true. That's not true. They sent us what, three pictures maybe over the years?
Yeah.
Those but that was a trauma and a loss that was unnecessary. I was not an unreasonable person. Okay. There was just fear.
Yeah.
And I think people, so I've also done like therapy with adult adoptees and adult adoptees whose parents like don't allow for a space to talk about adoption because they're sad. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're sad about their child's own adoption story and they bring their own grief to the situation and their own crap. Yeah. We all do.
Yeah.
But if you're unwilling to acknowledge that you are bringing a whole baggage of garbage to your adoption story and you're like, no, I'm perfectly fine. You're wrong. There's pain, there's grief, there's loss in every role within adoption. But if you tell a child like, oh no, we're just all a big happy family now, we just forget about that other stuff, that they'll do some interesting things to figure it out.
And my girls are struggling. Really struggling.
Well, how crushing for developing your identity and feeling like you have to mask or hide this piece of who you are.
And I think I always kind of felt like they were bad. There was something wrong with them because of where they came from. So,
yeah, there's just so many there. I don't want to get on and badmouth people, but there were so many stories that I heard about how their closed adoption happened that just shattered my heart and was just like unnecessary. I'm completely out of fear to try to keep them away. And guess what? It didn't work.
Yeah.
So we're here to tell you that doesn't work. Don't anybody do it.
No. They'll always reach out. And I think that was probably the biggest thing that got me through those 16 years of not seeing them, was that they're going to find me someday.
Yeah.
So, and they did, and moved right in. And now it's been a whirlwind.
Yeah. So I think
poignant stories. Yeah.
Yeah. I know what made it work for us. What made it work for us was compassion and like seeing that what we were doing was actually in the best interest of our kids. Yeah. Whereas I don't know that a lot of mental health professionals are like open or even understand that you can.
Yep.
They're still bought into this idea that says, oh, keep your family safe. Keep those other people, you know, their family over there.
Yeah.
Away from them and safety. Like, even if Stephanie had never gotten sober, and frankly, if she'd never gotten sober, we wouldn't have this thing. My kids had grandparents. My kids had aunts and uncles. My kids had this whole family that loved them from the day they were like even thought of. Just not something I could ever offer them with my family. And yeah, if you cut off because of safety, you're making the wrong choice. Yeah. Find ways. There's so many, like, I think about social media being available and all of this stuff that's now available that we didn't have.
Right.
If we could have seen pictures of the twins on social media, even, that would have felt like a decent connection that we wouldn't have had to like catch up or whatever.
Yep.
But the fact, there were just so many positive things in open adoption that, and nobody, I have a miracle. I get to have like the best bio mom ever, who is adaptable and flexible and sober and all of those things. And like, yes, I get that I made choices. You don't have to flatter me about it. I know that that's true, but I also get you, and other people don't get that. But I just encourage people every time that I talk about open adoption, find out where your boundary is. And then I'd like to say, what is one step further that you would take it to open it up just one step further? And why are you unwilling to do that? What is that about? Is it about you? Is it about your child? Is it about them? There are unsafe people out there. I get it. But that one step of allowing a phone call, that one step of allowing like an email address, open it up one more step. And what I found for myself is that as I went step by step by step by step, I got to have an amazing relationship with someone, and I'm forever grateful for that.
And her willingness to do that helped me tremendously become the person that I am today and in my recovery. That her belief in me and her interest in my life and my success was like a catalyst for so many things and where I am today. So,
yeah. Wow. That's so beautiful. Thank you so much, both.
Thank you. Thank you.
Do you want to talk about where you are today?
It's just been a privilege to watch Stephanie's journey. I've watched her go from being like a tire technician when she first got out, and she was the fastest tire technician in the county. Fastest, like not the fastest female, the fastest.
And I changed my tires, so.
She did.
I have
she
to
was really
that.
Awesome. That's awesome. She was super awesome. And then like she switched over, as many do, to like mental health and substance use. And I have watched her grow in being able to help other people, and what a gift that she is to people, because she is able to say, I did it. Mm-hmm. You too can do it. like, I joke all the time about how the same county that locked her up for crimes, a lot of money crimes, they now give her like a six-figure budget and say, hey, will you just manage that for us? Yeah. And you got it, right?
Yeah.
Because like she works at the Prisoner Access to Recovery Program at Wasatch Behavioral Health. And is like a department lead person. And she's in grad school. Yeah. And I am so impressed with her.
And I have to talk about Amy because she's incredible. Not only did she do her time at DCFS, which going through school and social work, that's kind of always been one thing that you're learning about. And I just knew that was no place I could ever be. She touched so many lives and changed so many families' lives. I still hear about her and like the amazing things that she's done, like when specific clients come in and know her or whatever. But she also put herself through grad school, and I call her my therapist because
and I call her my substance use counselor.
I love it. She's also the last... I hope you don't mind. So the last several years since she's got divorced, I know it's been difficult for her. She's taken on the role of being a single mom and has really had to, I guess, find herself outside of a marriage. And she has started her own business, too. And I got the pleasure of interning at that business during my bachelor's degree. And the environment that she has there is, you walk into that place and you just feel incredible. Like, and she's worked so hard at it. And she's also, she taught me how to be a parent because there was so much I didn't know. And she also taught me how to be a friend. I don't have hardly any girlfriends at all. I don't really like hang out with people, but she's always been the person that I can call when I need something good or bad. And she's just amazing now. And I mean, she's always been amazing, but I don't know what I could do, how my life would be without her. So,
yeah, I think I'm so grateful for all the things that we've built together. And yeah, I feel that is, yeah, if I have the best thing that I ever did in my life, you know, it's this.
That's for sure. How I feel. Talking about it really makes me miss our kids being little and all the things, because life's so crazy now. Like, we hardly get together like we used to or anything. Yeah. And it just really makes me miss it.
We have to figure it out.
We do.
Guys, that is so beautiful. Thank you. Okay.
We just want to give a huge thanks to Stephanie and Amy again. I loved this conversation and how vulnerable, open, and just clearly they communicate so many really important aspects of connection and relationships in the adoption sphere.
Yes, I love how supportive they are to one another, how they're validating to each other and to each other's motherhood instead of being threatened by one another. They really like back one another up, right? And I love that they have found a way to, within their family, like co-parent and make this very child-centric relationship where it's resulted in so much love and trust between the two of them as well.
Yeah. One thing that stands out to me, and I think of, you know, the first time adoptive parents going into a situation where they might have nothing in common with the birth parent. And in this case, you know, drugs may have been involved. And anyway, there's so many differences between people, and it takes work to connect with people and to form relationships. And sometimes you go through these storms together and, you know, all for the sake of these kids that connect us. And I think this was just a beautiful story of what happens for kids when parents, adoptive parents, biological parents come together and try to create this relationship this normal for them. And it takes a lot of work, and sometimes it's scary, and sometimes it may feel like unsafe. There's all these emotions and feelings around that. But ultimately, if we're doing the very best we can for our kids, it's going to bless them over and over and over again.
I really love that. And I love that idea that as the adults in these relationships, it's on us to really be the grown-ups here, right? And to forge these connections and relationships. And it's not always going to be easy. And it takes both sides working at it, right?
For sure.
But there was some give and take throughout the relationship and throughout time as Stephanie was getting healthy, and they were able to give one another this grace and understanding as they worked and continued to together strive for this relationship that they have now. And I think often in our lives we'll find that there can be things that come up that make it hard to keep an open adoption, right? Or to keep a relationship going that's challenging and maybe emotionally burdensome. But if both parties can really focus on what matters most, and that is the children, right? If both parties are focusing on the well-being of all of the children involved, then it's going to work and it's going to be worth it.
And I mean, I want to respect the privacy of other people that were spoken about in the episode, but I just thought it was really poignant at the end that, you know, she had other children that were adopted into different situations where it became closed. And, you know, right when they turned 18, the immediate thing was, let's connect with our birth mom. And,
That's a natural desire. I think, I mean, obviously we're not trying to project that onto every person, but it makes sense. And we've talked on the show before about how when, as adoptive parents, we vilify biological family members or don't talk well about them around our children, or in general, like even if our children aren't around, they're going to feel that, and they're going to feel like that is
part of their own identity.
Yes, part of their identity, and that's like a reflection on them. Because we're talking bad about a part of them, right? And a part of who they are. And it's so important to remember that loving your child also means loving their biological family. And that their biological family is part of them. And if you really want your child to feel your love as an adoptive parent, you need to embrace all of them. And that includes all of their family.
Yep. Even when it's hard, even when it's not convenient, you have to do it for the kid's sake, for sure.
Yep.
I love how that was painted in this conversation.
Me too. And I really, really appreciate that Stephanie is so open and talking about her personal experiences and challenges with addiction. That is something that's a very prevalent challenge that many people experience, but it's not spoken about very often, and it's challenging to talk about. And I really appreciate that she was open about that and shared with us, because it's something that happens a lot, especially in the adoption community. And there's hope and there's redemption, and she's an amazing person.
Yeah.
And she enriches her kids' lives. And it's this beautiful lesson that it doesn't, like, if someone's having a struggle today, it doesn't define the rest of their life.
Yeah, and kind of a tangent off of that, they spoke about this, and I think it's really important that, you know, she wasn't telling the kids
how... Amy, right?
Yeah, okay. Amy wasn't telling the kids how Stephanie was, quote-unquote, sick. Like, I'm doing air quotes right now. And then all of a sudden, that sickness led to her going to prison, right? And so they're both of them encouraging, like, tell the truth. Obviously, age appropriately, but tell the truth.
Well, she wasn't like lying, but and then just making it more open and transparent. I agree that kids can understand a lot more than we give them credit for.
Yeah. I really liked the reference to going to jail or prison as adult timeout.
Yeah.
It's like just a reset. Helping kids connect with that. I think I could talk forever about this conversation, but I'm just super grateful for, again, for both of them, for being so willing to be just so open and sharing so much.
Yes, I felt like it was such a helpful conversation for me, and I hope it's been helpful for you too.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your continued listening. We try so hard to provide really good content for the adoption community and hope that you found this helpful.
Yes. As we are wrapping up our current season, we're getting ready for a special November Adoption Month series that will be a little bit more frequent than our current episodes. And so we'll have a little more information about that soon. And in the meantime, if you would like to rate our podcast or share it with others who might benefit from it, we would love to help other people in their journeys.
Yeah. And again, we just do this because we love the adoption community and we want to share people's perspectives and opinions and ideally just paint the best future for all of our adoptee friends, whether those are our kids or someone else we're connected to.
Yeah. This really started off as us wanting to help people destigmatize open adoption and find less fear in that possibility. And it's grown into a lot more, but I think this episode ties right in, right? Yeah. That you can be so empowered by allowing more love into your life.
Yeah. So like Lynette said, like it, share it, whatever you can to promote the podcast in the adoption space, so that we can help reach more people. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Open Adoption Project.
This has been Fostering Conversations with Utah Foster Care. Thank you for joining us. For more information, go to utahfostercare.org. We'll see you next time.